That would be interesting because you've had people just sort of plug and play in the market. Like I said last time I talked with you about, they haven't really had to think about anything. They just put it in an index fund and forget it. Well, that won't work in these kind of markets. And so that's where we see it. We think the weakness will continue.
Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart. Even though both stocks and bonds have had a dismal start to the year, most investors aren't panicking yet. Instead, there's a lot of talk about the bottom being near and hope that much of the recent losses can be regained. That kind of optimism isn't seen in a real bear market, cautions Ted Oakley, managing partner and founder of Oxbow Advisors. In a true bear market, which he sees as likely to arrive as the year progresses, pessimism rules. It gets to the point where no one thinks stocks can ever go up again. We're far from that kind of capitulation and sentiment right now. Ted joins us today to share his outlook on how he sees the investing landscape playing out from here. Ted, it's wonderful to see you again. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Glad to be here, Adam.
Well, Ted, look, I have a lot of questions to get in here with you. But first, let's start at the top like I like to do in all these interviews. And let me just toss out the very general question. What is your current assessment of today's global economy and financial markets?
Well, as you know, for the last really 6 to 9 months, we've been negative on the market. And really, really negative on the European market. And so I think that continues for a while. I don't know where, but it's interesting to note that everybody is, every time I see something, everybody's trying to sort of pick the bottom. And typically when you actually are finished, everybody is like, hey, including us, probably, I don't know what's happening. it's that kind of thing. But we don't see that really. We see people not too worried. I mean, the crypto people obviously really worried right now. But for us, it just looked like it's going to be, you know, a classic bear market. You rally up a little bit, then you go back down to a new low, and you get some rallies along the way. And maybe we get a good rally in the middle of the year. I don't know. But it may be a situation where, you know, over the next 2 years or something, you just don't really go anywhere and you're in negative territory. That would be interesting because you've had people just sort of plug and play in the market. Like I said last time I talked with you about, they haven't really had to think about anything. They just put it in an index fund and forget it. Well, that won't work in these kind of markets. And so that's where we see it. We think the weakness will continue, and we'll just have to see, you know, what kind of where it plays out between now and the next 2 or 3 months.
All right. Yeah, the weakness will continue. All right. I'm sure that's a little depressing to some of the people watching who were sort of hoping the beatings were going to end soon. but I don't disagree with you. And there's lots of fundamentals that we'll get into here in just a moment. But you said something I think it's important enough to dwell on here, because I think we'll get more into it in a bit, which is that sort of the set it and forget it era of easy wealth building in the markets is likely over here. And one of the things that that I think people, most investors today, may still be underestimating is that there may still be a number of shoes to drop in this story here. You know, folks are looking back at the markets since the beginning of the year and saying, all right, there's been a lot of bloodletting, right? You know, bonds are down over 10%. S&P is down 16, 17% right now. NASDAQ's down, getting close to 30%. Bitcoin's down close to 40%. I mean, it's just, I think people are thinking, okay, well, you know, clearly this has got to be over at some point soon. And to your point, maybe there'll be a rally, maybe there'll be some stabilization. But inflation is still, you know, even though the CPI, you know, may have just peaked, inflation's still running hot. Cost of capital is rising. And, you know, if you look like in the housing market, I mean, that's another massive asset class that could potentially be due for a really painful correction here too at some point. So I'm not sure if people are quite as cognizant of the additional hits that could keep on coming here as we go through this year. So I want to jump into some specific questions for you, but do you kind of agree with this sense that, like, we may still be in the early innings here of a general correction?
Well, I think you're right, Adam, because if you look at it, you know, people are still in denial. You know, there's always a denial phase in sell-offs, and we're in the denial phase right now. And if you see
that's pretty much the first of the five stages of grief, right? Is you start in denial.
Right, exactly. And so you have to go through that for them to get to a point to where they just throw it in. And we haven't really seen that. I mean, and it's interesting on the real estate side, you can see at the fringes, that's starting. Okay. You're starting to see that. You're starting to see existing home sales down. You're starting to see a number of things that are changing. And if you talk to the mortgage bankers or the title people, which we do quite a bit, all of a sudden their business is really poor. That's a lead indicator too, by the way. And so once that happens, then the next thing to happen is I can't sell my house, so maybe I'll drop the price. Mortgage rates have a lot to do with it, but you're right. That's going to be the thing that follows on. We're starting to see, though, industrial metals, a lot of the agriculture stuff, a lot of things are rolling over from the high they were 2 months ago. Doesn't mean you're not going to have inflation. It just means that prices cure prices, and that's what we're starting to see. But that's the only thing in this right here is that, you know, right now, after you broke these new lows and all these averages, there's not a lot of rot underneath. I mean, you people can say, well, it's this number or that number, or whatever, but you have to get to a point to where everybody is just confounded. And they're like, you know what? I don't know. And I told somebody yesterday in an interview, I said, look, if you've been buying things for the last 6 or 8 weeks, and every time you bought something, it went down, you need to quit. You need to stop buying. That's part of it right here. And it's a sign. I mean, I learned that a long time ago. I had an old timer tell me that, said, hey, if you start buying stocks for 6 weeks and everything you buy goes down, the market's telling you something. So that's sort of where we are right now.
All right. Yeah. The classic, when you find yourself in a hole, first key step is to stop digging, right?
Yeah.
All right. Well, look, so let's start off here with the Fed, because Jerome Powell said something really important last week that, again, I'm not entirely sure the general investor has completely absorbed yet, where, you know, he said, look, it sort of surprised me that he admitted this, but he said, hey, look, we can't control the supply side at all. Right. Which in a number of ways, you know, an important admission that the Fed is not all powerful and that there may be things that keep inflation persisting for longer than the Fed would like because they're out of the Fed's control, right? And Fed can't control what happens with supplies of oil or, you know, key commodities. But he said, we're focused on demand, right? We want to bring demand down. And of course, that's the whole spirit behind the Fed's rate hiking program that it's embarked on here. And we can talk about whether or not folks believe Powell that he's got the backbone to do what it takes to really, you know, break the demand side of inflation. But right now, that's what he's saying he's going to do. And there's that old saying, you know, don't fight the Fed. And the people that tried to fight the Fed when the Fed was easing, you know, there's a lot of bears, you know, almost every bear got killed along the way. You know, will the bulls get killed going forward, or even just sort of the general populace that isn't expecting this, by fighting the Fed? Because Powell has basically said, you know, I'm bringing demand down, and you know that's gonna raise cost of capital. It's gonna depress asset prices. Do you think that the market is just waking up to the fact that Powell may be really serious about this?
Well, I think so. I the other thing about Powell on that is that if in fact a lot of the inflation is from the supply side, anything they do with interest rates will not help that. And that's interesting because they always make an error, and you know, they always ruin something and they blow up something. I don't know what it will be this time, but yes, I think people starting to think about it, because when you get a 550, 560, 30-year mortgage all of a sudden, and then you look up and your 401k is down 20%, and you're thinking, you know, I don't know about my house. Maybe I should sell. See, it starts to make them think about things. And it's just now sort of registering with them. When we were down 10 or 15, really, we didn't think people were really worried about anything. And now, though, it's going deeper. And I think they're starting to look at it. But it's just starting to take hold with them, because we can just tell by what they do. And I've checked a number of firms the last week on margin calls, and they don't have... They have some margin calls, but they don't have that kind of period where things are really in trouble and they're having to do workouts and things like that. So that all comes together, and you can put a, you can look at it like that and say, well, they're starting to see it, and now they're probably starting to believe it.
All right. Well, that's interesting. Let me just pull on that for 1 second. So I just rattled off some of the, you know, pretty material declines that we've seen in a number of the major indices, which, by the way, are propped up by those, you know, few great big companies with massive market caps. So, you know, the average companies in a lot of these indices have, are down a lot more, right? Especially in the NASDAQ. Why do you suppose we haven't seen a lot of margin calls yet? A lot of, you know, firms beginning to get in trouble who were too overextended?
You know, I think it's probably, I think some of them could have been hedged, but I think the biggest thing is that I think the price had gone up so high. If you look at in a margin account, you look at equity to margin, equity to debt. And I think the prices had gone up so high. And this is what I noticed, by the way. And I've checked with, you know, 4 or 5 major firms, and most of them were at a, say, an 80% equity level or 75. Now they're back at 55 or 50, but that's not margin call territory. You've got to get down in the 40% area of equities, which tells us that that alone tells you probably got to go another 10, 12, 15%, because that's what will cause those margin calls. And you can always tell margin calls because prices do really crazy things. You can't believe what they're doing when they start selling, when they sell you out. And we haven't gotten to that at all. But I think it's because of they've gone up so high the last 2 years that you could margin part of it. And you weren't like 50% margin. You only had 20, 25% on margin. However, you get a big break and that goes to 50% leverage, and then it's 60% leverage, and then you're in trouble. I think that's what's happened. That might be wrong, but I believe that's what's happened.
All right. Well, that's like another risk factor to add to the list then, right? Which is, hey, there was a lot of cushion in these accounts, but that cushion is now largely gone. And so that if prices, you know, go through another down leg from here, and you mentioned there's not a lot of technical support kind of close to where we are right now, you know, we could get to that point where those things get triggered, and then you get real trouble in the markets, right?
Right.
All right. Just back to my point about the Fed too. So, Ted, you're closer than I am to kind of, you know, the pulse of the client. Although I've got the firms that Wealthion refers people to, and I get real-time reports from them as well. I do think we are kind of right at that point, like you said, where people are opening their monthly statements and saying, oh, geez, you know, I knew the markets weren't doing so great, but I didn't realize I was down this much, right? You combine that with, I'm going to go back to what I was saying about Powell with demand side. So we could, who knows if we're going to get this, but we could have the worst of both worlds, which you were sort of alluding to, which is that, you know, there's potentially a lot that's continuing inflation that's out of the Fed's hands, yet the Fed is hell-bent on driving demand down. So you could have kind of all of the economic slowing impacts of what the Fed is doing without inflation coming down all that much if some of these, you know, factors that are outside the Fed's control, if they continue to persist, right? So you get this sort of really stagflationary, you know, sort of worst case scenario. I don't know if that's going to happen. I think it's probably a little too early to be able to make that call yet. But is that a potential concern of yours here?
Well, it is, because what happens is right now, you know, normally you don't get to a bottom of one of these till unemployment really goes up a lot, which obviously is not happening right now.
And sorry to interrupt, but I mean, during his conference, you know, Powell seemed to put a really big target on the jobs market. He kept talking about this historic sort of 2-to-1 openings to jobs ratio. So it sort of seemed like he was saying, you know, job market, I'm coming after you.
And he, you know, it's interesting. He doesn't see a lot of things, but if you just want to take home building stocks, home building stocks are down. Yeah, you know, they hit their peak in November, but all the home builders together are down 32, 33% just this year. You know, banks are down 25, employment services are down 30. I mean, these are indicators of what probably is to come. Now, I just think the Fed is always looking backwards, like we've always said, and that's why they ruin things, because they don't, if they had an ability, to say, well, we're going to try this because we think this may be happening in the next 6 months or 12 months. They won't do that. Too many academics, too many PhDs, and they always look backwards, okay? And that, because that's what they do. And right now, they don't have the ability to think, well, you know, maybe this could happen, so we have to be a little more careful. But I don't see them. I think they're right now with the print that just came out yesterday, that probably sealed the next hike, which we've been surprised all along that they get past two. But if they're hard-headed enough to do two more or three more, we're, in my opinion, at least, we're definitely headed toward a recession and a pretty good one too.
All right. So I agree with you. And, you know, people ask me, well, you know, do you think we're going to have a recession? And, you know, I say my honest answer is give me the reasons why we're not going to be going into recession. Like, the data I look at seems like we're very much on that course unless something really big changes fast. But Powell, you know, this kind of goes back to the comment you just made about the Fed. You didn't use the word clueless, but I'm going to sort of ask if it is, because Powell, in his speech last week, he said the economy is, quote, very strong. And then he said, quote, nothing about it suggests it's close or vulnerable to a recession. And, you know, it's kind of his job to tell people not to worry to a certain extent. But I mean, as he said those, I was like, why would you say that? Like, those are just words that are going to come back, likely going to come back to haunt you here. I mean, at the least say, we're doing our best to keep us out of recession or something like that. But he was sort of saying, I'm not worried at all about recession, where to me, it looks like a pretty high possibility, if not a probability. So what are your thoughts there?
Well, you know, he reminds me a lot of public company CEOs on call, conference calls. No matter how bad the news is and how horrible they are, okay, it doesn't make any difference. They try to make it sound like everything's okay. And so it's interesting. He's the same way, no matter what happens. And it's interesting because he always has this idea that, hey, don't worry, I got it taken care of, when he really doesn't. He didn't have it taken care of last year. And you and I have a mutual friend, David Rosenberg, who has a great chart out that shows the last 10 years of Fed projections. And it is really interesting because only their betting average on interest rates is about a third, 35%, I think. And on everything else, it's less than that. It's like 25. I think the GDP battery is 17%. So you can't really believe what they say. And so, because, you know, if something changes, and I've said all along, you get a 40 or 50% decline in the market, believe me, they show up really quickly and say, oh, we really didn't mean it. We're not going to be that strong. Promise you that'll happen, because they lean on the market. So we'll see, but that would be my guess.
All right. So Ted, you just answered one of the questions I was going to ask, which is a number of the experts I talked to basically say, look, the Fed's going to hike until something breaks, and then they're going to pivot and they're going to go back to easing. Sounds like you're in that camp, though. Don't let me put those words in your mouth. If you are, let me ask you two questions. What would something breaking look like? And then, you know, if the Fed were to pivot, what's your expectation for asset prices? Will they recover quickly, or like Bill Fleckenstein, and he's a little bit of a minority view here. He feels like if the Fed were to pivot, instead of going down, he thinks bond yields would go up, because he thinks that will be the moment where the Fed truly loses the bond market's confidence. So what do you think?
Well, what happens usually, though, the only thing, Bill's a good man. I didn't know what he said about that, but I will.
You don't have to agree with him. Don't worry.
And you know, I obviously know who he is for years. But the thing about it is this: when people get really, really scared, okay, and when you get down 40 or 50, they're scared. When they get really scared, they only go one place. They go to treasuries or CDs. That's it. If you go look at the nasty, nasty sell-offs in the market, are when that. I'll give a good example. Greenspan, when he came in late August 1987, came in and started raising rates immediately. And sure enough, when we crashed the market on Monday the 19th, he was on a plane. He stopped, got off the plane, said, oh, hey, let me tell everybody that just want to let you know we're going to provide tremendous liquidity, blah, 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 blah. He flipped it on a nickel. I mean, he turned it over. And these people, they do this because they know that That's a forerunner of the economy and a forerunner of GDP, because when you have those down markets like that. So I think, I'm not saying Bill could be wrong. I'm just saying that what could happen is in the short run, the bonds would rally. Okay. And they rallied, for example, off that 87 low, they rallied. They had come all the way down with the market for the last 9 months. And then they rallied to a new high while the market didn't go anywhere after that crash. But after, you know, another 6-9 months later, they rolled over again. Be something like that. It could be like that, where you, where the short run is you really get a trade out of the bonds. And then long run, people look up and say, hey, we're back in the soup again. So we'll have to see.
So you get a sugar high and then a sugar crash.
Yeah, I would think, because if we're in a truly bear market and a stagnant type economic period, which I think we are for the next 3 to 5 years, you're going to have a series of up, down, up, down, up, down. And that's where people that just plug into the exchange traded funds and indexes, that sort of thing, they never make any money because they never know when to raise any liquidity or when to put it back. And so that's where I think we'll be over the next, that longer term.
All right. So let's flag this to talk a little bit later in this discussion, because you, like a number of our recent guests, are making the argument for active management, that the era of passive management, which has been so easy and so successful with a massive central bank liquidity tailwind at your back, you know, those days are over. We're now entering an era that looks to be an awful lot more volatile. And that's where you're going to really need to do your homework and be smart and be nimble and all that. So let's flag to dig a little more deeply into that in terms of how your firm, you know, is doing that. Let me get back here real quick to the Fed. So if we get this pivot, and I know we're all speculating here, but if we get this pivot, what will happen to the economy and the consumer? Because essentially, if the Fed pivots while the inflation problem is not solved, easing is just going to make inflation worse again. And yes, maybe it'll goose economic growth, although we had a lot of stimulus over the past, you know, 12 years. We didn't get a ton of economic growth out of it when you look at the average GDP. So, you know, I guess what would the world look like after, you know, the economy look like after, you know, a return back to easing?
It would be okay for a while. I mean, it really, I'm not certain the economy rebound as much off of that as maybe the markets rebound a little bit. And let me give you a good example. We had the sell-off in 2000. It started basically topped the market April 1 of 2000. Had a big sell-off into summer and late summer, and had a little bit of rally. We ended up the year down, but we rallied off that low again, and then we just sort of rolled over and did the same thing. Now, economically, it came around a little bit. We really weren't in a hardcore recession or anything like that, but all of a sudden it was starting to work its way in to the economy. It works its way in. It starts with one, and okay, my wealth over here has gone down, and then this wealth over here has gone, and everything you look at all of a sudden, and then people say, hey, I'm sort of hurting. I look at it to be that way. I don't think it would be something where you would resume a bull market or anything like that. Maybe it gives you, from our standpoint, maybe it gives you a 20-25% rally, but then you have to get liquid again, in our opinion, the way things are set up.
Right. And kind of here's where I'm digging with this, because I get everything you said, but, you know, financial assets are overwhelmingly owned by the top 10% of Americans, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not really helping sort of the common guy. And the common guy is getting increasingly squeezed right now, right, by the cost of living and real wage growth isn't keeping up. The longer we go down this path towards recession, the more, you know, the job market begins to tighten. And again, Powell has put a target on the job market here. So, you know, unless that easing like dramatically gooses the economy again and keeps the job market strong, and you know, again, I'm going back to, if they haven't resolved the inflation problem, easing is probably just going to make it worse again. So I'm just wondering, if you get to a point here where, yeah, maybe you've goosed the markets by 25% or so, but the vast majority of people, voters, et cetera, are still just hurting and angry.
Well, they are because they always forget about what goes on Main Street, and they forget about people that live week to week and that sort of thing. And they don't care whether the market rebounds or not. They're just trying to make it right now. And so that's what they usually forget. And they have very little concept of what goes on Main Street. Everything they look at is a number that's given to them on a report. It'd be great for all of those FOMC people to all take a state or two and just go spend about a month walking down Main Street in some of these cities and talking to people. They'd probably get a lot out of that. But that's never going to happen.
I was going to say, the probability of that is.
But that's how you do it. You know, I mean, if you have an experience, but I mean, I grew up poor, so I know how to talk to these people. I can just ask them five questions and know where they are. And right now, you know, that's put them in a state where they're having to borrow again against their credit cards is what's happening.
Yeah. Well, and credit card debt's now back to all-time record high.
Exactly.
And that's what we're seeing. And I've actually talked about this a lot. And folks, if you haven't seen the video, I'll put up a link to it here. I did a 12-minute video just sort of dialing through all the lumps that the consumer is taking right now to the point where they are beginning to tap out. And one of the things that I show in there is that with the end of all the extraordinary support that they had through the pandemic in terms of the, you know, extended unemployment benefits and the direct checks to households and the child care credits and the rent and eviction moratoria and foreclosure moratoria and all that. And now we're coming up on the expiration of the student loan freeze, repayments freeze. You know, the cost of living has continued to zoom higher over that period. And they're basically now, since they're not getting that stimulus, they're just putting the difference on their credit cards. They haven't really dialed down their lifestyles yet. Maybe they don't have a lot of opportunity to do that, but it's all going on the credit card now, which, you know, we know has a finite expiration to it, right? You get to a point at which, you know, if you take on too much debt, you can't take on any more debt at some point because they won't lend it to you or you just can't absorb it anymore. So I hear that time bomb ticking louder and louder as we go along this trajectory here. But anyways, okay. So doesn't seem like you feel like whatever the Fed does in the near term is really going to help that all that much. And I don't disagree too much with that either. Okay. So a couple more quick things to get through in turn before we get to sort of like the what to do about it. You talked at the beginning about your outlook for the markets. I guess I'll summarize it in the terms of, you know, this ballgame may not be over yet in terms of the correction that's going on here. Is there anything more you want to say about your sort of current outlook on the markets, say for the next 3 to 9 months?
Well, I'd just say this, we're not hard headed. We've been around long enough to know that when something changes, we have to change, we have to adjust. And so if something changes that makes the world look better tomorrow or the next day, then we'll make a change as well. I've known a lot of people in the investment business that have died on a lot of mountains that they shouldn't have just because they couldn't change their mind. And one of the things about being around a long time is you learn that there's a lot of things and many, many things you don't know. And so what you do with that is stay wide open, mentally wide open to say, okay, if there's some changes happening, we want to try to catch them. But right now, we haven't changed anything because nothing gives us an idea that there's any reason for us to say, hey, this thing is really looking great to us. You have to remember a lot of these companies now use they're non-GAAP accounting. You know, they don't have GAAP accounting. So if you look underneath the hood, I mean, they play these Wall Street plays. They play these games now. They're incredible. And you got to really know what you're doing. These, you know, people, you can just buy an ETF on an index fund. You don't have a clue. I mean, but underneath these companies, they've been able to get away with everything the last 5, 6, 7 years. And so still are. But you have to think about that as you go forward, because it probably nothing's changed for us right now. We'll just have to see.
All right. So you know, you're still seeing us sort of in a phase of deterioration until you see something that changes. Yes, there may be some of these reflexive rallies along the way that you talked about, but right now you still have, I don't want to put too many words in your mouth, but you're skeptical, if not a little pessimistic. To your point about the non-GAAP earnings, I was interviewing someone recently, and I think it might've been Bill Fleckenstein again, who was railing about the preponderance now of non-GAAP accounting in the financial statements that you get from companies. Yeah. And he reminded me, he said this, and I was flashing back to my days as a junior investment banker back in the 90s, where he said you'd have to, you know, comb through all these prospectuses to analyze these companies, which nobody really does anymore anyways. But he said and this was true because I used to have to do this, you would comb through all the financials, which were all GAAP based. And then in the back of the prospectus, you would see the pro formas that the company would issue and say, well, look, if we did everything, if everything had happened the way that we had hoped it would, and if you accounted for this the way we'd like you to, you know, these are the rosier numbers that you would get, right? But that was sort of hidden in the back of the prospectus you had to dig through. Now it's the exact opposite. You really have to hunt in there to find out where the GAAP accounting numbers are, right? You get to get through all this sort of, you know, mark to fantasy accounting that they do.
Well, and the calls too that they do, if all these companies that are non-GAAP, they won't talk about GAAP earnings in the call. They just start bragging on themselves for non-GAAP. And if you look at it, you know, they give away a lot of the equity and the money that their employees earn. They're just giving stock to them. Well, they don't even book that, and they take intangibles, for example, and they don't amortize it. They do, I mean, things that you shouldn't do, by the way. And that allows them to come up with some number, non-GAAP, pro forma, that shows the earnings. When if you get under the hood and finish it all, they've never made any money. And so, you know, that's the way it gets, you know, that's what happens. And so you never do a private company that way. But that's what they do. And that's, you know, we've got these 1,000 unicorns we had out there that were all billion-dollar cap, you know, market caps. And a lot of those are like that.
Yeah, it's crazy. And for folks wondering what GAAP means when we're referring to it, it's an acronym, GAAP, Generally Accepted Accounting Principles. And it's basically a universally accepted standard for how to account for certain things. So from deviating from that, it's in my mind, it's sort of akin to like, you know, a pilot going into his cockpit and saying, look, I have all of these factory installed instruments that they put here on my dashboard that all planes are supposed to have, but I'm going to put a little decal over my fuel gauge that just always reads full, right?
Well, that's really sort of the way it is. You're right.
Yeah. All right. Well, real quick, I'd love to get your thoughts on a few other markets. We talked briefly about housing. I think my general question to you is the housing market more vulnerable than people are expecting right now? We sort of talked about the fact that people are just beginning to wake up to like, oh, the markets are maybe a little bit more vulnerable than I thought. We gave a little bit of a nod to the, you know, number of different issues that are putting, should put downward pressure on housing prices, chief amongst them, mortgage rates going up and going up pretty dramatically. You know, I've mentioned on this program many times that mortgage rates have almost doubled if you look at 30-year average fixed mortgage rates since last summer. And because of the mathematical, you know, it's not an opinion, the mathematical relationship between mortgage rates and housing prices. Housing prices need to come down to adjust just for that alone, but there's a number of other factors out there too. How well appreciated is this right now?
Well, I don't think it is appreciated, but I think one of the things they leave out on it, Adam, is that if you assume that 70% of the mortgages are less, current mortgages are less than 4%. Let's just say the average is 360, 350, 360, and that's the average. Then what happens is that sets up an incredible immobility where, okay, if I want to move up to a larger home or I want to do something along that line, now all of a sudden I'm going to take what is a really low payment on a relative basis. That's going to get really big. And people forget about this, but I don't know what's going on where you are, but here in Austin, we just, in all of the state of Texas, we just had the taxes come out for, you know, estimated taxes for real estate. I would assume that these averages are like 30, 40%. So you got to, you know, you have to factor that into it as well. Even if you homestead it, if you're going to crack, you're moving up a higher price house. So now you've got a number of things working against you. You got the payment, you got a higher house price, you've got taxes that are higher, and believe it or not, insurance higher because you got a higher price house. So they forget about all these factors that come into play. And what you've got now, and I talked to realtors, is they say, well, the things we have now are in the pipeline that are going to work. They're already queued up here at the mortgage company. But the new things that are coming on, and they're talking to build, they used to go out to a new builder, and you had to really kind of get close to them as a realtor to say, look, hey, give me a shot at getting one of these new specs that's coming out of the ground. Just give me one or two. And so you sort of who you know kind of thing, or you wouldn't get it. Now you can call them up and say, yeah, you know, I've only got one person ahead of you or nobody, whatever. And we'll see how that plays out, but it always catches up. And I think it'll catch up this time as well. It's so far above the, if you look at real estate residential relative to the CPI, it's 44% above the CPI. It never does that. It got up to 33 or 34 back in 2005, 2006, 2007, and it got plastered all the way back to the line. And this time probably is no different.
All right. It's really interesting. So yesterday I released a video of an interview I just did with a senior researcher at the Dallas Fed who had just published a report saying that there's a housing bubble. And I was actually shocked that the Fed would actually issue a report using those terms and that this fellow would come on and talk about it. And he was a really good sport. He was constrained clearly about how much he could say. But to me, it's like when it gets to the point where the Fed is actually saying, hey, folks, there's a housing bubble, you know, there's a housing bubble going on, or at least you know that the future of prices going forward, you know, is at risk, right? And that's basically what this guy's, you know, sort of, it was the advice I was able to pull out of him, where he just said, yeah, look, if you're looking to buy a house right now, you know, do not be stretching, do not be, making that decision based on the need to flip it in a year to somebody else at a higher price, because those days are probably gone.
And they may get rid of him, Adam. He may not have a job.
Well, I know I'm going to feel badly if I email him in a month and he's no longer there. I guess at a high level, the question I want to ask you, because you deal with investors, and at the end of the day, even though it shouldn't be, everything should be incredibly dispassionate because we can, you know, use numbers to come up with valuations and stuff like that. But investing is primarily emotional for the average investor. And a lot of times our emotions can be our worst enemies here. And so we hear about this thing called the wealth effect, which in a lot of ways is sometimes official policy is, you know, hey, we want to support the housing market so that people will feel flush and they'll go out and spend in the economy and then that'll boost growth. I'm increasingly worried about a negative wealth effect coming on, because just as a wealth effect can create a virtuous cycle, you can have a vicious cycle created by a negative wealth effect where people just, you know, they just contract in and they don't want to spend at all. And, you know, that begins to build on itself. And that's when deflation really sets in here. So, you know, I'm worried if the market keeps correcting and then we get this size, the type of size of the correction of the housing market, I think both you and I think is possible. You kind of get this twin shotgun barrel of really big negative wealth effect drivers. How material do you think that's going to be going forward?
I think it will be material. You know, we do a lot of work with people who have a lot of money. Most of them had a liquidity event of some kind. You know, they could have left a public company, could have, a lot of them sold the company. And most really, really high net worth people had some sort of liquidity event to get, not all of them, sometimes your second, third generation, but a lot. And so those kinds of investors are not like a young investor that can sort of put a little money in the market every month and don't worry that you've got 40 years to go or 50 years to go minimum. They're in a situation where what they have is what they have forever. And so they are in a different situation. So people can tell me that it won't affect them, but it will. I've seen too many. Because no matter whether you have you know, 10 million or 100 million or 200 million, when you lose a big piece of it, it still affects you no matter what. And I've had people, you know, people think that it doesn't, but it does. And we've been around too many people that have a lot of money. So it affects them. I think what affects them here is that they'll feel like they had X amount of dollars that would last, you know, a long, long time. If you're in the wrong allocation though, and you end up with a third less or more, then you're in a situation where you're like, oh man, I probably should have gone a little different direction. I've seen that before, but it will have an impact on them, because I've always said, no matter who you are, when you start losing millions, you'll wake up, and they do. And so I suspect they will this time too.
All right. I want to dig into your clientele in just a minute here. But before we do, let me ask the last of my kind of big picture questions, then we'll get to tactics, which is, okay, given this whole environment you and I have just been talking about, I'm going to assume that you perhaps have become pretty defensively positioned here, but I don't correct me of that opinion if it's wrong. But basically, how are you riding out this current correction in the markets?
Well, you know, we have three strategies. We keep it really simple, and we have a stock strategy. We have a really aggressive income strategy. It doesn't own bonds, it owns other things. And then we have a really conservative strategy that's in sort of bulletproof things. I'm talking about very high grade munis, treasuries, that sort of thing. But what we're doing in all those strategies is this: all of them have at least 40% liquid. The equity account's about 50% liquid. The high income account's about roughly 41 or 42. And the conservative income account is really liquid because we have so many things we own there that are only that are short term. But to tell you what's going on, I'm going to take the conservative side. It's a great time for people to look out and buy 1 and 2 year treasuries or 1 and 2 year really high grade municipal bonds. All of a sudden, the municipal market is about 95% of the treasury, which is close. That's when you're getting close to a time to really buy the muni. So we've been able to put a lot of money to work in 1 year, 2 year, and 3 year paper because you couldn't get anything before, but now you can. And that's in the conservative side. In the mid-side, high income side, what we're doing is you can still buy REITs because they have an inflation factor built into them to where, you know, they can raise the rents. They're not like other things, but they can raise the rent. So certain kinds of those work well. Really also what we have in that account is if you look at the too big to fail big banks, they have some great preferreds. And now they're up around 6.25% to some of them 7%. And those are banks that have already been deemed over the last 15 years, too big to fail type banks. All of them, you know, only taxed at 20%. So you have it, you know, they're qualified dividends, and that looks great to us. We've got energy in there and some other things. But and then on the stock side, we have more liquidity. We have over 50% there. And the reason being is because in these bear markets, I could show just about anybody, and I've told a lot of young people this, that no matter what you think the fundamentals are of your company, when the game changes and you go into a bear market, almost every stock goes down, and it doesn't make any difference how great they are. And so you can obviously buy things at a cheaper level. And one of the things I mentioned the last time I was with you a number of months ago was you have to have enough liquidity to live to play another day. I keep mentioning to people, but particularly people with a lot of money, there's no reason for them to have to try to get up and run with the market and do all that. So they can have a really balanced look and do really well for the rest of their lives, and because they've got plenty of money. They don't have to try to get into this game of, you know, my portfolio is beating your portfolio. What they should be doing is saying, am I invested correctly so that I can meet what my financial goals are till I die? That's how they should be looking. And forget about what they hear at a cocktail party. Okay. Just try to go that way. And I think that's where we are in our three strategies. And we've got, I have to say, we're doing really well this year, but the reason being is not because we're brilliant. It's because we had enough foresight to have some liquidity to say our best years, by the way, have always been at lows. 09, 03 was the best year we ever had. 09 was the best year we ever had. And it's just because we had liquidity. And when you got liquidity, well, you have liquidity, you can make money. But you gotta have it.
All right. Were those years so good because when the dust settled, you had the liquidity to then deploy when valuations were super attractive?
It's true. And you on the way down, you make errors. I'll give you an example. And the market peaked at roughly 14,000, 1,700, the Dow in September of 07, October. And it came on down. When it got down to about 8,400, we put some of our liquidity in, only about a third of it, not realizing we're going to go down another 25%, which we did. Went down to 6,500. Then we really got aggressive and put a lot of money in. And that's how you work in these kinds of things. You have to wait till you really sort of see the whites of their eyes to get fully invested. But you can tell when it is. And that's when nobody wants anything. And we wish we haven't gotten to that point yet. I mean, all I see now in the press and on TV and everything is that, okay, I'm recommending this, I'm recommending that. And every time they recommend something, come back a week later and it's down. So we're in that sort of time now. And I think people, whereas we got a lot of heat really a year and a half ago, 2 years ago for starting to build liquidity, a lot of people gave us a hard time. But by the way, they gave us a hard time in 99. We didn't own any tech. We had accounts that left us. But that's okay if that's what they wanted to do. But they, you know, it was the right thing to do. And sometimes the right thing to do is not the most popular thing to do. And
exactly.
So that's where we are right now.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's something that, you know, the advisors that we work with here at Wealthfound, it's one of the things that I have held them up for a long time, which is, you know, they're confident enough to take the slings and arrows and resist the pressure of whatever the popular, you know, investment craze is to do the right thing. And that can be very hard sometimes when that trade is going against you and people are making tons of money. But it always comes back in spades when the correction comes. And you guys are a great example of that as well. All right. Well, look, as we begin kind of concluding here, your firm, as you mentioned, specializes in the needs of high net worth clients. I think sort of your typical client is somebody that's had a big liquidity event, like an entrepreneur who's had a business for decades that they've sold, and they're now suddenly sitting on a bunch of cash and wondering, what do I do with my life, right? Because my job was my life, and now I don't have it anymore, and I have all this money, but I don't know what to do with it. Or perhaps someone who, you know, sells a really big real estate parcel or comes into a big inheritance or something like that. I got a couple questions for you sort of about these people. First off, what are they doing with their money right now? Now, obviously, they're perhaps investing in some of the funds that you mentioned, but is it spread amongst both public and private types of investments? Like when somebody comes in and says, look, I got this big chunk of money, how do you help them think about how to allocate it? And even though everybody watching this isn't an entrepreneur who just sold their company for $20 million, I think we can all benefit from looking at what those who do have a lot of money do with it.
Well, you know, it's interesting. It breaks down too. If you look at people that have already had that liquidity event, maybe they have a family office or something like that. If you look at their spread of assets, it's really not all in it's not all in financial assets. You know, they have a pretty good spread. I wrote a book entitled Psychology of Staying Rich. And I had interviewed quite a few billionaires in that book as well. But one of the things about it is that, and it's about what we see in the current, they're typically going to have, they're going to have real estate, they're going to have private businesses, they're going to have some startups probably, and then they're going to have that section that has stocks and bonds and cash. Most of them have quite a bit of cash as well. When somebody new walks in the door right now, and we've been telling them this the last year, and it really has worked out. I'll have to tell you, the last 8 or 9 months, we've had some real big liquidity events of people that sold companies, different things. And we convinced them that for the time being, that the stock and the bond market was not where they needed to be, right? It doesn't mean we wouldn't get there. But we said, you know, real estate's expensive. Private companies are off the chart expensive. I mean, they're paying too much. That's not an area for you. And stocks and bonds, why don't we just hold here for a while till we get a really what Warren Buffett calls a fat pitch? And And that's worked out really well for us this year because they've been able to really see that, you know, there is this period you go through where you should do nothing. And we've always written about in other books we have about people that sell a company. And we always ask them, for the first year, we'd ask you to not do anything. Now, you don't have to choose us as a firm, but whatever firm you choose or whatever you do, don't buy the narrative line. Just settle back in the cash, get used to your lifestyle, get used to your, you know, being with your spouse, male or female, you know, all the time. They're not used to it. You know, kids, there's a lot of things emotionally, you know, emotionally they're wrecked because they're used to having their ego stroked and they can't get it anymore. So there's things that happen. But right now, what you want to try to do and what we would do when they walk in the door is this, and we'll say, look, we're going to own a lot of short paper for you. We're on a little bit of stock, but if our idea was to eventually own 35% stock, we're probably not going to own more than 6 or 7 or 8% right now. Because we don't know for sure what the future is. So we'll own some of this stuff. We'll own a decent piece of high income, but we'll also own a lot of cash because all high net worth people typically, not always, but most of the time, they're going to look at real estate. We like real estate a lot. We think it's one of the best, if not the best investment you can make, but you got to go into direct deals and they're all expensive right now. All the things that we're into with our clients over the last 10 years in real estate, we've been doing nothing but selling the last 18 months because the cap rates are so high that you have to sell it. It's such a stupid price. You got to sell it. So when they come in right now, we say, hold up on the real estate, hold up on the private equity, the private business right now, and hold up a little bit on the stocks and bonds. It's a time to hold that liquidity and let's just see how it shakes out here. Now, if it looks like things are really changing, you know what? You have liquidity. But the second part of that is if things really get dire, you will have done the right thing. And it's different. You know, if you sold a company 10 years ago and all of a sudden you have a lot more money now than you had then, that's one thing. But if you just did it, you need to be thinking about that pot. And that's one of the things we see with people. And also we're seeing a lot where the older generation, which has a lot of money, is dying. The second generation gets it. We've had a hard time with that group explaining to them that, look, you're probably not going to have this again. Okay, you got it now, but you need to start thinking about you're younger and you've got a long way to go here. And so you need to think about that. Sometimes they listen to us. Sometimes they don't. I mean, we've had a lot of them lose tremendous money. And
sometimes they just put it all in a Dogecoin.
They do. And that's what I started to say. That's what we've seen. And I've seen them go out and buy all of these VC companies that are just popping into these SPACs and certain things. Believe me, take my word for it. They're getting murdered. I mean, right now as we speak. And that's just where we are. And you have to, and it's not, by the way, that's not all second generation or third generation, but it's a lot. And if they could think about it like this to say, okay, or this is a real godsend for me, we will have this kind of money. Then if they can protect that and break that asset through, it'll really make a lot of difference in their life.
All right. Well, look, that perspective is all super valuable. And I got to wrap things up here time-wise, sure. Unfortunately, Ted, but a couple quick last questions for you. One of which I'm tempted to make a future video with you just dedicated to this. But if you could give me just sort of a shortest answer you can, you know, you're working with people who have achieved a lot of success, right? And one of the more fascinating and useful books I ever read was The Millionaire Next Door, which was, you know, a research survey of self-made millionaires, but most of them were self-made. Mm-hmm. You know, it basically just gave you sort of an analytical breakdown of the attributes they had and which ones correlated the most with successful wealth building over time. So I'm just curious, what are some of the top qualities, attributes, mindsets of the people who you work with, these successful people that have, you know, created all this value, you know, what do they tend to have in common?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think it was Mr. Stanley that wrote that book. And I talked to him many years ago. That book's been out a long time. And what he was saying was this, if you look at bootstrap type entrepreneurs that made all their money, you know, they didn't have to go out and show people they had the money and that sort of thing. One of the things we find with the most successful investors is that they're not really trying to prove anything to anybody. You know, I don't need, you know, I don't need four Lamborghinis and two yachts down in the Caribbean or that sort of, and they have just as much money as everybody else does. But what they do is, and I like this about them a lot, is they concentrate on the goodness of life. They enjoy their life. They're not trying to live for somebody else or show everybody else how much money I have or that sort of thing. And they've got lots of money, believe me. But they live for their, they've got good families. They put it back into that thing. And then they have great philanthropy, which I really admire them for. And they have, that's the one. And those are the people we really enjoy doing business with. And the reason is because they, number one, they understand risk because they were in business. And number two, they understand that, hey, you know what? I need to enjoy this ride.
All right, great. Well, that's super useful. I think we all can take inspiration from those attributes, you know, focusing on what matters most and not caring about what the rest of the world thinks, not feeling pressure to, you know, keep up with the Joneses, and also having some sort of mission sense of life and giving back and whatnot. All right, great. I think that could be a really interesting video. And folks, if you want us to dive deep into that next time we have Ted on, let me know in the comments section below. Also interesting, Ted. So I'd love to compare notes with you further at some point because Stanley has sadly died. I did interview his partner, William Danko, last year for this program, and it was a wonderful conversation with him. So it'd be fun to sort of exchange what I learned from Bill Danko and what you learned from Tom Stanley. All right, so folks, as well too, Ted, as you were talking, I was thinking it might be good to do a special event. I honestly don't know how many viewers of this program are in your target segment, these sort of high net worth people, especially those that have had a liquidity event. I know the vast majority aren't, obviously, just from sheer numbers. But if folks, if you're the type of person that, you know, perhaps could benefit from the guidance on TED services, I'm kind of kicking around the idea in my mind of maybe doing a special event, special seminar, webinar for the high net worth individual, which, you know, we can bring Ted, we can bring another specialist in that case. If you're interested in that, just send me an email at info@wealthion.com. If there's enough interest in that, we'll think about doing something. I also think it could have benefit for just all of our regular viewers too, because you're seeing the decisions, you know, the issues that these people have to wrestle with and the decisions that they're making with their money. Ted gave you a little bit of a preview of that, but that could be something interesting. If there's enough interest there, we'll do it. Ted, thank you so much again for giving us so much of your time today. Really have enjoyed this conversation as always. For folks that perhaps hadn't known you before, but have gotten, you know, enjoyed getting to know you through this discussion and would like to follow you and your work, where should they go?
The best place to go to the website, oxbowadvisors.com. You know, there's a lot of things there. There's a book you like, we'll send it to you. But that's the best place to go.
All right. Fantastic, Ted. Well, look, folks, if you've enjoyed this conversation, if you'd like us to have Ted on again in the future and other great guests of his caliber, please help support this channel by hitting the like button and then clicking on the subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. Ted, thanks so much again for giving us so much of your time. Everybody else, thanks for watching.
Thanks, Adam.